right, go ahead and have a seat, please. Good afternoon. We have with us the UW Pre-Law Society. Do you want to stand up so we can say hello? Wow, good group.
Good.
Nice.
All those budding lawyers out there.
Wonderful.
Very nice to have you here today. We hope you enjoy visiting with us. Go ahead and have a seat. Calling 20AP 2012 CR State versus James P. Killian. I have your appearances. All right. Good afternoon. 25 minutes followed by 35 minutes on rebuttal, correct? All right. Let's proceed. Oh, by the way, Justice Kurowski is appearing by phone today.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chief Justice. Where a prosecutor intentionally provokes a mistrial, the Double Jeopardy Clause provides a significant remedy for that misconduct. It bars a second prosecution for the same offense. Applying that rule here, the state cannot retry Mr. for two serious crimes involving sexual abuse of his daughter and his pseudo-granddaughter. But by its plain terms, the Double Jeopardy Clause does not bar a second prosecution of Mr. Killian for different offenses. And there is no dispute in this case that under the controlling legal standard, this second prosecution charges different crimes from the first prosecution.
You use the Blackburger test. Is that what we should rely on?
Correct, Your Honor. That is the only test that, at this point, is used to resolve whether two prosecutions are for the same offense. Now, the Court of Appeals reached a different result because instead of focusing on the actual crimes charged in the two prosecutions, as Blackburger analysis requires, it homed in on the prosecutors talking about the possibility of adding charges in the first case, believing that a defendant can sometimes be in jeopardy for uncharged conduct. That conclusion finds no support in precedent of this Court or the U.S. Supreme Court. Double jeopardy analysis focuses on the crimes charged because jeopardy means actual danger of conviction, and a defendant cannot be convicted of a crime for which he is not charged. This Court should reverse.
Help me out here with that, because I understand, and I'm struggling here on what how to look at this in light of Section 971.29, which is the provision that says that at trial, the court may allow amendment of the complaint, indictment, or information to conform to the proof where such amendment is not prejudicial to the defendant. And where I've seen it in practice is a case such as this, where you might have a certain time frame that then, once the evidence comes in, gets extended. Or you may think that the repeated sexual acts of a child is going to include this, that act, or that act, but then the child testifies and they're a child, and they talk about a different act. So it's the different act that winds up being part of that. So that's where I'm struggling with your very clear-cut, only look at the pleadings, and yes, only look at the evidence in the record as they relate to the pleadings. What about 971.29 sub 2?
Well, so we are advocating for a bright-line rule today that you are not in jeopardy until there is an actual charge, because that is the point at which the jury gets to decide the question of guilt or innocence. They don't have that authority before a charge exists. And in this case, just to be clear, the charges in the first prosecution were clear at trial.
Right. I'm not talking about this case. I'm talking about your bright-line rule.
We do believe that our bright-line rule is fully consistent with both precedent from the U.S. Supreme Court and this Court in terms of the definition of what it means to be in jeopardy, which is real risk of conviction, actual danger of conviction, and you cannot be convicted of a crime for which you are not charged.
I understand, and I think that maybe that our court, I think that, first of all, we might be unique in this amendment. I know that in the federal court, you cannot amend a charge, so what the U.S. Supreme Court says about that may not address our particular statute. I don't think our court has been addressed with this issue square on. So I get that what you said is correct. No one said differently. But I still am not hearing from you what I'm supposed to do about 971.29 sub 2. How do I square that with your bright line rule?
Applying the bright line rule would mean that the defendant is not in jeopardy until the charge is added, until the information is amended.
So until the end of the trial, when it's actually amended, even if the evidence at trial expands the time frame, it's allowed into evidence, there's testimony about it, the state could then cause a mistrial and then go on and charge the defendant for the same type of conduct, and I get that these circumstances may not occur a lot, but that could happen under your reading of this just because we haven't gotten to the end. The mistrial could happen the day before the case is over, at which point it's clear that we're talking about a time frame that goes not ending at 94, but it clearly ends at 95. There's been 5 witnesses that talk about it. It's clear that that's what they're going to ask to do. I mean, what do we do about that?
I hear what you're saying, and what you're saying is you don't think that this bright-line rule is perfect. And it might not be perfect, but I'm going to push back because I think the alternative rule that was espoused by the Court of Appeals, and I'm not clear on what the boundaries of what that rule are, is really difficult to administer.
And I agree with that, too, which is why I'm struggling.
And to your point, Justice Stout, I will note, there has been this kind of criticism over the Blockberger test as well. It's not a perfect rule, but it's the most workable rule that we have. And that's what we're asking for. We're just asking for a rule that is simple to apply. We do precedent at this point in time.
And the fact that the state's the one that caused this mistrial, we shouldn't be, I'm going to say if we're going to stick it to someone in that kind of situation, it's the defendant?
I'm going to push back on that because we have suffered consequences from the prosecutor's misconduct in this first prosecution. The victims have suffered consequences from the misconduct in the first prosecution. We are forced to bring these victims to relive their trauma through a second prosecution, and we are not allowed to try 2 very serious child sexual assaults. So there have been consequences for what happened in this first prosecution, and I acknowledge that there are probably facts that we do not like about what happened in the first case, but I think at this point we have to separate the facts that we don't like from the law that we have to follow. And this is a double jeopardy claim. Double jeopardy principles tell us that the only misconduct that's relevant here today to the analysis was the intent to abort the trial. That's what triggered the double jeopardy bar, and that's why we're here asking whether this is a second prosecution for the same offense.
Thank you.
I do want to go back to Blockberger. Again, we do believe that the law is clear that that's the only test that we use for determining whether 2 prosecutions are for the same offense. It requires a comparison of the actual charges between the 2 prosecutions. And the Court of Appeals said that it was applying the Blockberger test, but it didn't really. Because when you look at what it did, it compared theoretical charges in the first prosecution to actual charges in the second prosecution. And that's not the Blockberger test. So I think what really happened here is that the Court of Appeals created a new test for deciding whether 2 prosecutions are for the same offense. And again, I'm not clear on what this test exactly is, but it essentially asks, did the prosecutor talk about adding charges in the first case or attempt to add charges in the first case and then later actually bring those charges in a second case? And if the answer is yes, the double jeopardy bar applies.
Sometimes the cases speak in terms of risk of double jeopardy. And inherent in that term is not an actualization, right, but a potential. So how do you deal with that phrase that you see with some frequency?
Sure. But I do think the cases also clarify it has to be a real risk. It has to be actual, as this court recently said in Schultz in consulting with dictionary definitions of the term of jeopardy. It's got to be actual danger. We're talking about actual exposure. And again, our bright line rule is there is no actual danger of conviction if you don't have a charge because you can't be convicted of a crime when there isn't a charge.
But the information could be amended, and Schultz really does address this. In Schultz, we said limiting our review to the complaint would not protect defendant against double jeopardy if the state introduced evidence of a sexual assault occurring after the charging period. Isn't that what we have in this case?
Again, the issue in Schultz was you had an imprecise charging period allegation, and this court said you can look at the entire record to see what the actual charges were, right? We view Schultz as being a tool to decide what the actual charges are. And so applying that in this case, we would look at the charging documents and we would look at the evidence that was introduced up until the point of the mistrial to discern what the actual charges were. So we're not fighting with the proposition that the Schultz rule applies in determining what the scope of jeopardy is in a prior prosecution that ends in a mistrial. What we're disputing is using Schultz as a tool to not just look and see what the actual charges were, but to use it as a tool for hypothesizing or speculating based on facts in the record what charges might have been added had this thing not ended in a mistrial.
But again, Schultz was a different case.
Absolutely.
It's apples and oranges here, but when I'm looking at the principles, and I wrote it, so I'm looking at the principles we espoused as a court in that case, we did suggest that the defendant is exposed to double jeopardy if the state introduced evidence that was outside of the charging period, because, of course, the state could amend the information.
Well,
it does expose the defendant.
It's my understanding, though, that in that situation, the evidence that would have been introduced would have still been tied to an actual charge. And we're not disputing in this case what the actual charges were in this first prosecution. So we acknowledge, for example, in the case of Brittany, that other acts, inadmissible other acts evidence did come in, which, of course, led to the mistrial. But that wasn't tied to an actual charge. That's the whole point of why the mistrial was declared, because it wasn't on trial.
In response to my question, you aptly said, you focused on the word actual jeopardy. Actual jeopardy. But in some ways, isn't that an oxymoron? Because jeopardy doesn't necessarily mean, this is in response to my question regarding risk of jeopardy. And you said you need actual jeopardy. But jeopardy doesn't necessarily connote a done deal, so to speak. It's not Merriam-Webster, it's Ann Wolfe Bradley, I guess, on jeopardy. It's the potential. You're put in jeopardy. You're put in danger. There's the potential for danger. Jeopardy is inherently not an absolute. And so,
I'm
not persuaded. I still think that there's a risk.
I see what you're saying, but I think that the concern is, what's the standard then? If we don't have a bright line rule that is connected, we think, to precedent, saying you can't be convicted of a crime for which you aren't charged, I don't know where you draw lines based on the Court of Appeals test in this case. I don't know how many comments about amending the information are too many. I don't know if it's enough to just make comments about uncharged conduct during opening statements. Maybe if you combine that with an attempt to add a charge before the trial starts, maybe that's enough. I think it's a really unworkable test the way things stand right now with the Court of Appeals opinion.
I think of other acts evidence cases where sometimes other acts are uncharged conduct. And they come in because they fill in a piece of the puzzle with respect to a trial on a separate and distinct charge. If we were to adopt the arguments here of opposing counsel, wouldn't that mean that you could never, even if you subsequently acquired evidence regarding that uncharged act, if that evidence came in another trial, you could never charge it?
Well, and Felix says that's not how double jeopardy works.
So we'd have to overrule that concept.
I think that if you were to adopt the Court of Appeals analysis and Mr. Killian's position, you'd have to get around a lot of precedent. I think you'd have to get around Felix, which bases jeopardy on the actual crimes charged. I think you'd have to get around the Smith decision that we cited in our brief that says double jeopardy analysis focuses on the individual offense charged. I think you'd have to get around Schultz's definition of jeopardy, meaning actual danger of conviction. I think you'd have to get around this court's decision in Winnie, saying you can't be convicted of a crime for which, by the way, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that as well. And I'd also point this court to Surfass v. United States. That is also cited in my brief. That talks about jeopardy attaching at a proceeding where the trier has jurisdiction to decide the question of guilt or innocence. I think you're going to have to find your way around all of those cases to adopt the Court of Appeals analysis, which notably cites no precedent for its new test for determining whether two prosecutions are for the same offense, and no precedent for this theory that you can be in jeopardy for uncharged conduct.
What if someone on the court wanted to take a look at prosecutorial misconduct in the context of a mistrial in that regard? How, if at all, would that apply?
Could you clarify your question?
With the prosecutor, some might think or view the record as the prosecutor causing this mistrial through their conduct.
Yeah, so the prosecutor the prosecutor's intent to abort this trial, which the circuit court found occurred here, is what's triggered the double jeopardy. Like, that is the consequence for those actions, right? But I'm not aware of any precedent that says we can look at other types of misconduct that happened in the first case, and the double jeopardy clause provides additional remedies for that misconduct. The double jeopardy clause just speaks to barring a second prosecution for the same offense, not for different offenses. And that's why I'm saying we really need to we need to follow the law that's at issue here today, which is a double jeopardy analysis.
Can you think of any case where double jeopardy was invoked to not allow subsequent charges of evidence in a trial that was not directly evidence of the crime charged?
No. And again, we think Felix shows that Felix very clearly stands for the proposition that just because evidence comes in as other acts evidence in one prosecution doesn't mean you can't charge that, actually charge that conduct in another prosecution.
You're not disagreeing at this point. I mean, the state purposefully and egregiously induced a mistrial with the express purpose of adding more charges. And that's not even before us because that was never appealed, right? We're starting with that premise.
We accept the circuit court's finding that there was an intent to abort the trial. And again, that's why we're here talking about whether the double jeopardy clause bars this second prosecution. And the question is whether these are the same offenses as in the first prosecution.
Counsel, if the your argument is the double jeopardy clause is not, you know, essentially a tool for sanctioning bad behavior in the prior trial, and I understand that, what are some of the tools that are available in the case of bad behavior? And, you know, Justice Dalla talked about some of the risks that could come with, you know, what you've acknowledged are admittedly some imperfect and fuzzy tests.
Sure. So, and maybe you're kind of getting to, I think Mr. Killian has advanced some policy concerns about, you know, is this going to incentivize prosecutors from withholding charges and aborting trials? And as we noted in our brief, there's really little to gain from that kind of strategy. This kind of strategy is forcing victims to have to relive their trauma through a second prosecution. No prosecutor is going to want to do that. The other thing I would note is a lot of times when prosecutors have a pool of charges from which to choose from, they often choose their strongest charges to pursue because they pick the ones that are easiest for the jury to follow. They pick the ones that are going to be easiest to approve. So in this type of scenario, a second prosecution may be harder to pursue. The other thing, and I'm sorry, Justice, am I answering your question?
Yeah, that's great. Keep going. Yeah.
Okay. The other thing I would note in terms of addressing misconduct is certainly there are other avenues to punish a scheming prosecutor. There are OLR complaints that can be filed. There are elected, you know, DAs or elected officials. There can be elections. There can also be recall petitions. So those are other avenues to address that type of misconduct as well.
Thanks. The test that you propose, a bright line rule, it doesn't matter whether the court indicated a willingness or unwillingness to expand, you know, or change the charges. I know there was some, you know, obviously some discussion about that. That wouldn't be relevant under your analysis, right? Really, you're saying the best line is the line when it's actually changed.
Correct. Okay. That's correct.
You know, some of us have struggled with Blackburger over the years. And as you indicate, you know, it may not be the perfect test, but you advance that it's the best test we have. Give me a Blackburger plus. I mean, what can we do better? Because it's been a for me, it's been a problem on occasion over the years.
I don't want to give you a Blackburger plus in this case. And quite frankly, I think this court has considered doing a Blackburger plus. We cited the Kurzawa case in our brief. That came after the United States Supreme Court in Dixon got rid of the Grady test. That's the same conduct test. That was a test in addition to Blackburger. And this court followed the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Dixon, which said, yeah, there's just one test here. Maybe it's not perfect, but this is the most workable standard. And an alternative test like the Grady same conduct test can produce some pretty unjust consequences for victims. And what I would say is, in this case, I think the Court of Appeals' new proposed test also can produce some very unjust consequences for victims, and I'd like to talk about that a little bit today, especially with respect to Ashley's case. She alleged a 10-year pattern of sexual abuse at the hands of her father. We charged roughly a 5-year period from when she was around 12 to 15 years of age. We didn't charge from about 6 to 11 years of age, and the result of the Court of Appeals' opinion is because the prosecutor, really mainly because of the prosecutor's actions with respect to the other victim's case, with respect to Brittany's case, were not allowed to charge about a 5-year pattern of abuse that spanned from, you know, second grade to whatever grade 11 years old is. And we think that's a very unjust outcome. And again, unjust results was a big reason why the U.S. Supreme Court in Dixon got rid of the Grady test and said there's just one test that we're working with.
Schultz focused on the record, right? The majority in Schultz. So you're saying no, don't take a look at the record.
We are saying that you can take a, so when a prior prosecution ends in a mistrial, we agree that you can look at the entire record to discern what the actual charges were, what was actually on trial at the time of the mistrial. All we're pushing back on is this idea that you could use Schultz, search the entire record, and look, grab onto facts and speculate about what might had happened if the trial was completed.
And so in your argument, isn't inherent in your argument that the actual charges may not be in the charging document? I mean, why else do you look to the whole record to discern what the actual charges are? I mean, why don't you just open up the information?
Well, I think most of the time Schultz is just a really useful tool when you have somewhat of an imprecise charging period allegation, right? We know that the charging period allegation in Schultz was something, fall. What does fall mean, right?
Early fall.
Yeah, thank you. And so Schultz was a really helpful tool in trying to clarify what that charging period allegation meant. In a case like this, I think that there were two unambiguous charging period allegations here, but we still agree that you could look to the entire record to protect the defendant's double jeopardy interests and see if something might have happened. Like I gave the example in my brief. At one point, the prosecutor argued, no, I've charged a course of conduct, not just grabbing Brittany's buttocks. If the circuit court were to have agreed with that and said, you know what, yeah, that is how I interpret the complaint, I think that that should be relevant to what the scope of jeopardy was. But that wasn't the situation here.
And that would be, though, what I hear you saying, because I'm trying to figure out where your lines are, in a situation where it's done, it's over, it's gone to the jury, then we could look at the record because then
yes.
We would know what that conduct was.
Yes.
So until that time, we're not really looking at the record.
Well, I think in a situation of a mistrial, I think you could look at the charging documents and what had come in at the trial so far up to the point of the mistrial.
Right, but until it's you were saying before, until it's actually put to a jury, until it's an actual charge, it doesn't put you.
I guess what I'm saying is if,
yeah.
Sure. So if the charging period allegation isn't totally clear, I think you could look at how the case had been tried up to the point of the mistrial to say, okay, this was
right.
Most likely the charge. Yeah.
Your argument, counsel, as I understand it, is that yes, you can look at the record, but to determine what was actually
correct.
Charged,
correct.
Not to expand or modify it.
Correct. Correct. It's a bright line, workable standard. We believe it's consistent with precedent.
We did that in State v. Ziegler, where there were multiple identical charges, but the proof of each of the counts was different.
Correct.
So they were different counts.
There are no further questions. Thank you.
May it please the court, this is a case about preventing and prohibiting the state from benefiting from its own decision, from its own egregious misconduct, its deliberate sabotaging of a jury trial so that it can go back to square one and essentially start over. The facts essentially are that we had a prosecutor who had a fact pattern and had to make a strategic and a deliberate decision as to what charges to bring with respect to that fact pattern. And those charges backfired, either because the prosecutor wasn't aware of what he could and couldn't get away with in front of the judge, or the prosecutor was unclear on the law. And then the prosecutor, realizing that the decision had backfired, deliberately sabotaged the trial for the specific purpose of going back to that same fact pattern and making new strategic and deliberate decisions as to how to charge that case.
We have somebody else that's involved in this case. It's two young girls who are victims, and we have a constitutional amendment that we must look to the victims' rights as well as looking to the defendants' rights, correct?
Yes.
Okay, if I follow your argument, where have you taken account of the victims' rights?
Well, the victims have had a right, just like the defendant had a right, to have the tribunal that was impaneled make a decision as to Mr. Killian's guilt or innocence. That was a fundamental right under the Double Jeopardy Clause, is to not allow the state to sabotage a trial when it's not going well, but rather to let the tribunal make that decision. If the jury was going to convict Mr. Killian, that would have been in parallel with the victim's rights in this trial. If they were going to acquit Mr. Killian, then in all cases of an acquittal, the victim is found to essentially not be a victim of those crimes, or at the very least, the defendant's not found guilty. But certainly, the Double Jeopardy Clause, as the Fourth Amendment, certain constitutional rights, of course, conflict with the victim's rights. And in this case, it was the state's deliberate attempt to sabotage the trial, and I think that must... Being able to have a circuit court circumvent the state from doing that is essential to everybody's right to a fair trial.
So, counsel, your position is that the Blockburger test does not govern when the state behaves badly, as is, you know, was the finding here and is not challenged?
No, I believe that Mr. Killian was prosecuted for every charge that he was prosecuted for in this case, in the previous case. They weren't formally charged because the prosecutor's strategy was to charge it a particular way, to have one charge in the charging document, with, at least with respect to Brittany, and then fewer charges with respect to Ashley, but to bring in the entire course of conduct and, as Judge Becker found, amend the information after the evidence came in. Now, why the prosecutor did it that way, we can only speculate, but the point is the prosecutor was indeed prosecuting Mr. Killian for those charges. Cases like Felix, in cases where we have other act evidence that was ruled in, that was ruled admissible, is they're very distinct from a case where we have an active prosecutor specifically intending to prosecute charges beyond what were specified in the information, and then again sabotaging the trial in order to go back and do that.
So, what was the criminal penalty for the other acts evidence?
I don't understand the question.
Well, you're saying he was charged, so he faced a penalty for those other acts. What was that penalty?
The penalty was if the...
How much jail time for the other acts?
I believe they were essentially the same. I mean, we can look at the criminal complaint that's in front of you in this case would answer that entire question, because it's the same. What was being prosecuted when the...
And well, I'll it's part and parcel of the charged crime, right? You're saying it's part of the charged crime?
No, I'm saying the charged crime on paper was initially limited to an August 18th allegation of sexual contact that occurred and allegedly occurred in 2014.
And what was the date of the other acts evidence that you say was inappropriately admitted?
They were approximately 6 months or so around that date. Again, if we look at the information in this case, that would answer that question directly, because it's specifically derived from the exact same facts, that the prosecutor intended to bring.
A different time period, not the same date.
Well, the prosecutor successfully expanded the date, so it is arguably within the same time period as the expanded date. But the argument for why those other acts were being prosecuted, they're not other acts in the sense of 904.042B. They're other crimes that the prosecutor is seeking to prove up in this case and then to amend the information.
At the time the prosecutor was seeking to prove them up in this case, what was the penalty associated with those other crimes?
And I don't have that right in front of me, but it was...
Where's the count that...
In the
were they charged? Were those other acts charged?
There was one, well, just with respect to Brittany, there was one act that was charged. And then there were numerous other acts that were brought in.
Right.
And what those...
And my point is, there was no jail time associated with those other acts.
Well, there's two...
At the time they were brought in, what penalties were associated with the other acts?
At the time they were brought in, the information had... The prosecutor was not yet successful.
Yeah, there
the
was
information
no jeopardy
hadn't been amended.
At the time they were brought in.
Correct. And where I differ as far as the definition of jeopardy is not... The line isn't where the judge agrees with the prosecutor and amends the information. Generally, that happens after the jury, after the evidence comes in. I would argue that when we have a case such as this one where it's an established fact that the prosecutor is seeking to prove these other counts and then seeking to amend the information, even though the prosecutor wasn't successful, the fact that the prosecutor is intentionally prosecuting those crimes in front of a seated jury rendered Mr. Killian in jeopardy for those charges, despite the fact that the prosecutor was unsuccessful. The prosecutor derailed the trial because he got the impression that he wasn't going to be able to...
Isn't what you're saying contrary to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Felix? I mean, they talk specifically about other acts evidence and what federal statute it's permissible of, and they specifically say bringing in evidence of other acts is not the same thing as prosecuting one for those other acts.
An essential finding in Felix was that the state wasn't prosecuting the defendant
right.
for the other acts.
Right.
And because the other acts in Felix were being used to establish a state of mind, they
yes.
weren't being used to subsequently amend the information and get convictions on those other acts. I think it would have been incorrect, I argue, for the court to find that Felix was not being prosecuted if, in fact, that prosecutor had brought in these other acts with the specific intent to use them to amend the information and then get convictions and then through the trial.
How does the, talk about biasing a jury, how does the jury know what the prosecutor is bringing in other acts evidence testimony for?
The jury at the time that the evidence is brought in would be instructed at the end of the trial.
Right. So they don't know. They don't know why the prosecutor's bringing in this other X evidence, right?
Right. But the fact that the intent of the prosecutor and the conduct of the prosecutor, I would argue, means something in respect to the jeopardy. Oftentimes, prosecutors seek a conviction and they're unsuccessful. And in this case, Judge Becker found the prosecutor was prosecuting charges beyond the information, and the prosecutor was ultimately unsuccessful. But to say we should just ignore that part when we look at jeopardy doesn't seem to coincide with, number one, the fundamental principles of double jeopardy, not having somebody get repeatedly charged with a crime, not having the state with all their resources and power be able to subject somebody to multiple prosecutions. And I think most importantly, the defendant's right to have the seated tribunal make a decision as to the issues that they're being asked to decide. And at the time of the mistrial, at the time that the prosecutor derailed the trial, the jury hadn't been asked to decide anything yet. They hadn't been instructed on anything yet. But that doesn't mean that Mr. Killian at the time wasn't in jeopardy in the sense that he was at risk for there being a prosecutor seeking to get convictions for these offenses in front of a seated jury.
How does your rule apply? Like, that's what... when would we know when they were in jeopardy? Because here we've got a situation where the court was shutting down the prosecutor's arguments. I think from this record it's pretty hard to say that the court would have let the prosecutor amend the charges. So under your test, it's just whenever a prosecutor wants to amend a charge, and how do we know what they want, and how much do they have to show before we know that that's what they want? And that sounds pretty, I'm going to say loosey-goosey because that's the only thing that comes into my head when you're talking about double jeopardy. How would we ever apply that?
Well, and I think it's a rare case because it's rare that the prosecutor's intent is, but in this case, the judge made that finding based on...
Right. But how would we know, according to your test, how do we know what your client was in jeopardy for? What are we looking at constructively in the record when here we've got a court saying, I'm not going to let you amend it. It's just the prosecutor wanted to, so we're going to make a rule. You want a rule that says whenever a prosecutor wants to amend based on new charges that person's in jeopardy? Is that the rule you're asking us to find?
When the prosecutor intends to amend the charges and when that's demonstrated, and then when the prosecutor...
Wait a sec. When is that demonstrated? Like, what am I looking at? Like, how are we going to apply this?
Well, I think we also have to look at the fact that at the time that the prosecutor deliberately caused a mistrial.
Well, we start with that premise. We're not even in this world until that happens. So you got to put that. So they've deliberately done that, and I agree with you. That's rarely going to happen. I don't know that I've seen that admitted by everyone to start with. Okay, so put that over here. Now, what do we do? How do we know? How do we know the prosecutor just because they intended it?
Well, we look at the opening statement. As the prosecutor mentioned all the crimes in the opening statement, we look at what the prosecutor tells the jury that it intends to prove, which in this case the facts under the indictment in the former case were exactly what the prosecutor is seeking to prove in the subsequent case.
Justice Krofsky would like to ask a question.
Yeah, first of all, I just need to push back on a statement you made earlier about the victims. The victims don't lose their status as a victim just because there's a mistrial or just because there's an acquittal. That the definition of a victim under 950 is someone against whom a crime has been committed. So they remain, their victim status remains. But my larger question regarding the double jeopardy test here is that I don't understand how it could apply here. Justice Anwash Bradley a little earlier was talking about the risk of jeopardy. How could there have been a risk of jeopardy here when the judge said over and over and over again, you are not going to introduce these charges. These charges are not going to become part of this trial. And in fact, that's the whole reason that there was a mistrial. So I don't understand. So you're saying if the prosecutor intends, like, how are we supposed to determine that? And as far as other acts evidence is concerned, the bar is much, much lower for introducing other acts evidence. So I have a really, really hard time. I don't understand the Court of Appeals opinion, and I'm having a hard time understanding what test it is or what the holding of our case would be. Do you really want us to say that if a prosecutor intends to add any extra charges, then jeopardy attaches to those charges? Thanks, Chief.
Thank you. And I'd want to first distinguish between other acts evidence and evidence that the prosecutor seeks to admit with the mission of amending the information. And I think the justices are having trouble with the factual finding. How are we going to find whether or not the prosecutor had the mission of using those charges to amend the information? And I think it will be a rare finding to make, but it exists in this case, and that finding was made in this case. And with respect to other act evidence and the threshold for getting that in, this wasn't admissible other act evidence that was admitted for a specific purpose. This was a pattern of behavior in the prosecutor sneaking in these other crimes that it was going to use to amend the information until it realized that it was being, that it was unsuccessful, and then committed the mistrial. And if we don't look at the mission of the prosecutor at the time that the mistrial is caused, then it opens the door to a lot of abuse from the prosecutor. If essentially, in a case like this, which is not all that rare, again, the prosecutor has a lot of facts and can make decisions as to what charges to bring, and the prosecutor brings some of the charges, perhaps the more easier ones to prove, perhaps the more serious ones, but they seldom, in my experience, will bring every conceivable charge from a fact pattern. And if the court says the mission of the prosecutor is irrelevant, that only when they're successful at convincing the judge to amend the information, if only then jeopardy attaches, well, prosecutors can use this threat throughout the trial and say, well, guess what? If you don't agree with this, then we're just going to bring another trial, or we'll bring 10 other trials. And if you don't agree with the rule, if you choose to continue to make the objections that you're making based on the circuit court's rules, well, then we're just going to try this again with the charges that we withheld from the information, or the charges that we weren't successful with in amending the information. And frankly, they can coerce the defense to concede the amendments during the trial, because otherwise the defendant's under the threat of facing another prosecution, which is exactly what happened in this case. That's exactly what happened in this case. The prosecutor deliberately defied court rulings again and again, and then at one point said, stop objecting or we're just going to recharge all this, and then eventually sabotaged the case with the specific intent of doing that. So saying that even if it might be hard to prove or hard to identify, saying that the prosecutor's intent and mission doesn't matter when we look at jeopardy opens the door to a lot of coercive charging scenarios that the prosecutor can make.
I have some concerns about this well-written and very persuasive, but not persuasive enough because I joined the dissent, but it was very well-written majority opinion, State versus Schultz. And it seems as though what's developing is just look at the charging documents and that's it. But the majority cites in over and over again the premises, for instance, in paragraph 30 and 31 and 2, for purposes of barring a future prosecution, it is the judgment, not the indictment alone, which acts as the bar. But more importantly, it goes on, and then the entire record may be considered in evaluating a subsequent claim of double jeopardy. But more importantly, when a double jeopardy bar is claimed, the court must examine not just the indictment from the prior proceedings, but the entire record. Later on it says, it's the record as a whole, therefore, which provides the subsequent protection from double jeopardy rather than the indictment. Paragraph 32, it is the record as a whole, therefore, which provides the protection for double jeopardy rather than just the indictment. And so it seems like with Blackburger, you're just examining the charging documents. And yet we have, oh, it's not quite a litany, but, you know, I don't know how many you need for a litany. We'll decide that on another date. But you, like four or five citations to just what I'm saying, that it is not only the charging documents that you review. When a double jeopardy bar is claimed, the court must examine not just the indictment from the prior proceeding, but the entire record, etc. So how does that square with embracing the just give me the indictments only approach?
And I think if I don't think that it does. I think that there are circumstances, including the Schultz circumstance, where the indictments do not sufficiently explain what the charge is. And the test that this court set forth or adopted in Schultz is whether facts alleged under either of the indictments would, if proved under the other, warrant a conviction under the latter. And there's no reason to go there if we're simply comparing indictments as mathematical formulas under the Blackburger analysis. I think the question is what's being prosecuted, and occasionally there's something that's being prosecuted that's not, that the record will identify that may not be accurately and completely reflected from the indictment. In the Schultz case, it was the state attempting to prosecute a charge that was in a different time frame than the subsequent charge. In this case, it's the state attempting to prosecute a number of crimes that are outside the indictment of the crime charge.
Why shouldn't we just look at Schultz, as your opposing counsel indicates, as almost like sui generis? Okay, it deals with the charging time period. And in those instances, and in those instances only, you go beyond the comparing the indictment.
Because I think that would, for one, it would rule out a scenario like this, where the argument is that there were charges being brought that were outside of the indictment. Even in Schultz, I believe Justice Ziegler indicated that we look very carefully through the record to see if there was any suggestion of sexual activity that might have happened in October, suggesting that if there was any evidence or suggestion by which the jury could have found sexual activity that occurred in October, that would have created jeopardy. And I think if we analogize that to this case, if we look at the acts that are being charged in the subsequent case, those are all mentioned and specifically brought out in the trial in the former case.
Your test seems awfully imprecise. That makes me nervous, because then it's not workable. Tell me why it's not imprecise. Tell me why it is workable.
It's workable because it only applies if we are able to identify the mission of the prosecutor, as we are in this case, and where the prosecutor intentionally causes a mistrial, which is where it's rare for either of those to happen. I think it would be very rare to be able to say, well, the prosecutor is prosecuting these other charges besides the ones that were specifically spelled out in the indictment. And it's incredibly rare, at least by my research, for a prosecutor to intentionally cause a mistrial so that it can start over. And I think that's really the only thing that this case speaks to, is when we have a prosecutor that had a unique mission of prosecuting charges that were outside the scope of the indictment, and then intentionally through the trial, that's where I would argue double jeopardy should prohibit that prosecutor under the rule established in Schultz, where the record demonstrates what the prosecutor was actually charging, and that dictates what Mr. Killian was in jeopardy for.
So it depends on the prosecutor's intent. What if it accidentally comes out? Does that different analysis, even if it's the same facts?
Absolutely. If it's an inadvertent disclosure, if it's not a finding that the prosecutor intended to use this to charge another crime, then I don't think any of this analysis would apply.
Would the prosecutor need to be called to testify on a motion like this about the prosecutor's intent?
In this case, he was. I think in most cases we wouldn't need to get that far. I think judges could fairly oftentimes dispose of something, as witnesses say things all the time that they're not supposed to say. It's rare that we have a record like this that thoroughly establishes the prosecutor's defiance of the court's
findings. So if the evidence adduced, is outside of, say, the scope of the charging documents, you would agree that that person isn't under jeopardy until it's changed. But if the prosecutor intentionally elicits information outside of it, then you think a different standard applies? Is that what I'm understanding you say?
And can I answer that question? My red light is on.
Yes, you may.
I would say that the prosecutor, when it's not simply the intent, it's the prosecutor attempting to charge crimes that are outside of the indictment and then deliberately causing the mistrial. In this case, we have a very solid record of what the prosecutor was seeking to prove and the fact that he was continuously prosecuting this case up until the point that he caused the mistrial. It's going to be rare that we have that, but in this case, I think it's very distinguishable from a case where there's an inadvertent or even something that comes out that maybe shouldn't have, but it's not specifically intended to create jeopardy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just two quick points. First, I want to push back on this idea that if this court were to adopt this new vague rule, that it would rarely be applied, because if what causes jeopardy is just the prosecutor's conduct alone, as we noted in our reply brief, I don't see that there's anything preventing a defendant whose trial is actually completed, and we know that those charges didn't go to the jury, from coming back and saying a second prosecution for different crimes is barred because the prosecutor attempted to add a charge in that first prosecution. So I think that this rule could have far-reaching consequences if this court were to adopt it.
Findings of fact were made here. If in a future case a judge in a similar situation, just an egregious action by the prosecutor to goad a mistrial, if in review motions after whatever the circuit court made a finding of fact that in several places in the trial from the trial record it's clear that he was attempting or she was attempting to prove uncharged offenses. If that kind of finding was made, does that alter your analysis or argument?
No. It's still not charged. It's a bright line rule. You're not in jeopardy unless there's an actual charge.
Except for situations like Schultz. I mean, you're saying Schultz is sui generis all by itself when you're dealing with the time frame.
Maybe I'm not following you, Justice Bradley, if you want to clarify. I'm not sure I agree with how you're characterizing what we're saying about Schultz. We're simply saying Schultz is a tool for discerning what the actual charge is in the first prosecution. You can look at the charging document. I think normally if you have an unambiguous charging period allegation, you're not necessarily going to need to consult with the whole record, but you can as part of that exercise in clarifying what the actual charge is. We have no problem with that rule.
Schultz sui generis. You can look to the whole record argument rather than just the indictments. Is it just applying to situations where the time period may be in question?
I don't read Schultz that way. I don't read the opinion that way. I think it applies whenever you're trying to discern the actual scope of jeopardy in a prior prosecution. But I agree that the facts of Schultz were a situation where you did have an imprecise charging period allegation.
So you use Schultz to clarify what has been already pled? Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Okay.
The only other thing I wanted to push back on is this notion that we already prosecuted Mr. Killian for the charges that we currently have. We define prosecuted as pursuing convictions for actual crimes charged. We think that's consistent with how the U.S. Supreme Court has talked about what it means to be prosecuted. If you look in Felix, they say Felix wasn't prosecuted for anything in the first trial except for what he was charged with. I think Mr. Killian's definition of prosecuted and the Court of Appeals' definition of prosecuted in this case, prosecuted with respect to Brittany's case, meant attempting to add charges, and prosecuting with respect to Ashley's case meant simply referring to admissible other acts evidence during opening statements. We completely disagree with that being prosecuted for conduct.
An opening statement isn't even evidence.
Correct. Exactly. There's nothing further. We're asking this court to reverse. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Okay. The court will adjourn. We'll continue.